Welcome to a joint hearing of the House Health and Human Services and Education Finance Committees. Very pleased to have you all here. Chairman Dean has asked me to go ahead and kick off the meeting, and I know we've got a very distinguished panel of testifiers from the agencies here to present to us today. So I just wanted to frame up sort of the purpose of today's hearing and why we're doing it jointly. In the governor's budget proposal, there's some significant interaction in some of the initiatives he's kicking off in the area of sort of the broad category of early childhood education. And I know if in the education arena that's meant certain things, and there's also programs within the Department of Health and Human Services that certainly impact on the lives of very young children and their families. And some of these initiatives definitely involve expenditure of funds from both categories that have been within the area of education and some within the area of health and human services. So today's hearing is to try to more fully understand what the governor is envisioning and to discuss sort of how that would interact with how we understand programs as they currently operate and what those changes would bring about. So with that opening comment, I think we will go ahead and turn to our testifiers. So Commissioner, or whoever wants to join us to kick off and do the presentation at the table, we would welcome you. All right, Commissioner, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Lucinda Jessen. I'm Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Human Services. And I'm just going to open by saying a few words and then, if I can figure out how to make that. And then we're going to kind of go back and forth. We try to provide kind of an integrated overview. So instead of here's what one department's doing, here's what another's doing, and here's what another's doing, really to kind of go back and forth as we walk through the governor's proposals. And that is really the way we try to put the governor's budget together. As I think you all know, the governor really wanted to make children the focus of his budget. And the governor, and you know, and I know from those of you who heard from me on the Health and Human Services Committee, know that I as well am really troubled when we look at the number of children in our state that are living in poverty, and especially those that are living in deep poverty. We have 78,000 children living in deep poverty, and we know that the best ladder out of poverty in the long term for those children and their families is education, and especially the research tells us early education. So that's why the governor's budget makes a number of proposals that will go through both from the Department of Education and the Department of Human Services to look at reducing or eliminating waiting lists for poor children, to provide more quality child care and quality early education using our Parent Aware program, looking at more pre-K programs that were broadly available to children. And the governor's budget also recognizes that for children to be ready to learn, they need to be safe and they need to be healthy. So you'll see as well some proposals that deal with, for example, some of the dental access issues, some of the initial that fund at least some of the initial recommendations from the Child Protection Task Force. And also, to be safe and healthy, we need to do more, the governor believes, in the area of mental health. That while we have a number of good mental health providers, we have real gaps in access, particularly in greater Minnesota. So with that, I would like to, Madam Chair, turn this over to the first set of slides from Melvin Carter, who is head of the Office of Early Learning.
Welcome, Mr. Carter. Nice to see you.
Thank you very much. It's good to see you as well. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Melvin Carter. I direct the state's Office of Early Learning. We're an interagency office of the state's Departments of Education, Health, and Human Services, essentially for the purpose of doing better on behalf of young children and their families working together than we can do working separately. You can see our vision on the slide. All Minnesota children get the great start they need to succeed in school and life. I know that you're aware of the investments that we've made as a state in young children, and our goal is essentially to make sure that those investments are operating not just as a list of programs but as an investment portfolio, as a portfolio of investments that are really working well together in pursuit of an agreed-upon return that we're working forward. I want to share with you that we are making some incredible progress, incredible momentum in our state that is absolutely being recognized nationwide in different corners. We right now have over 5,700 children across our state receiving early learning scholarships across our entire state. That's fantastic. We have just under 1,900 rated parent aware providers statewide. I understand that from 2013 to 2014, the number of rated non-accredited family child care programs increased by 150%, and the number of rated non-accredited child care centers increased by nearly 100%. I think that's important for a couple of reasons. It's important, one, because that's where we have the opportunity to really turn the curve for children and families across our state. I think it's important, too, because just a year ago in this same room, we had a discussion about our challenge engaging non-accredited providers and state agency staff across agencies, worked with some of the partners in the room right now, private sector partners, philanthropic partners, advocates and provider groups to really do some outreach, and that turned around really fast based on that work. So I think it's also important because it's a huge show of the effectiveness that can happen when folks work together across agencies. 80% of the children on Pathway 1 scholarships are choosing four-star providers, so that's phenomenal. 29% of the children on CCAP around our state under five years old are in three- and four-star rated providers. That's important because our parent aware system, quality rating system, has been such a critical centerpiece of our investments in young children and determining and being able to communicate to families what quality is. That number, which is higher and sooner than I expected it to be, indicates that families are hearing that, and they're using that criteria as part of their decision-making process. I think that's something that's important for us to recognize. We've made a lot of progress, like I just showed you. We also, as Commissioner Jessen mentioned, have a lot of challenges before us that remain. We know that in Minnesota, and I'm thankful for DHS for providing this information, that one in four will have some kind of mental illness in their lifetime. Mental illness is more common than gray cars, to show you just how common that is. We know that children, low-income children, don't have access to preventative health and dental care services the way that they should. We know that the number of homeless children is rising, and we know that, as Commissioner just mentioned, we have some real challenges in our state as far as having too many children who live in poverty in our state, and also too large disparities that exist in our state. We're working together across agencies and across sectors because the truth is the problem isn't any one of those challenges I just shared with you. The problem is all of those challenges I just shared with you and the way they work together to produce a really vicious cycle for families, for communities, and for our state. And we know that turning that cycle around is going to require not any one great program can do it, not any one great agency or any one great organization can do it working in isolation, but it requires a real cross-sector effort and discipline towards working together toward our common goals. I want to share with you, as we do our interagency work, it's based really on this principle that what we desire for our children is access to high-quality early care environments that are using research-based best practices to ensure that our children are learning and on track to be ready for kindergarten and reading for third grade, because we know that those are critical benchmarks in a young person's life. We also know that it's important for those young people, if we want them to reach those academic and learning and cognitive benchmarks that we know are so critical for their lives, it's also important for them to be in a safe, stable, secure home and community environment. It's also critical for that they have every opportunity to grow up healthy so they can actually be around to enjoy the great life we're sending them on the road to. And so we know that that whatever extent we are investing in making sure that Minnesota children are healthy, that making sure that they're stable and secure in their home and community environments, those things will stand to bolster our attempts and our efforts to make sure that they are learning all of the things that we want them to learn. There's a couple of underlying philosophies, I think, in the governor's proposal and all the things that you'll hear here today. One is we need a robust system. with different ways for different families in different parts of our state to access care and learning environments. As a parent of two young children, my girls are 6 and 8, with a birthday coming up, 6 and 9 soon. I'm not looking for the one thing that I can do to guarantee my children's success. I'm looking for everything I can do to guarantee my children's success. And so I think that's the way that we're looking at this and saying, what's every angle that we can approach serving children and serving families in our state? And that's how we kind of move it forward. I think equity is a huge focus. I think it's a tragedy. As we discussed in this space before, it's a tragedy that in Minnesota and elsewhere around our country, but certainly in Minnesota, you can look at a child that's born and predict with too good reliability just based on how that child looks or where that child lives, what that child's life outcomes are likely to be. So whether it's zip codes, racial or ethnic groups, or tribal nations, we know where the children and families are who are at greatest risk of getting left behind. And that's a sad fact, but it also gives us an opportunity to target our efforts for the greatest effectiveness. The other piece I think that is a huge underlying philosophy of our work is alignment. I share with our team sometimes. I went to college on a track scholarship, and anybody who's ever ran knows that a relay team with four really fast runners loses to a relay team with really good exchanges. And so we know that we have to get really good at exchanges, whether that's throughout a child's age, from being a baby to being a toddler to being in our school system, whether that's across disciplines, going from school to the doctor's office, whatever that is, we have to get really good at our exchanges. So alignment, both within an age group and across age groups, within disciplines and agencies and across disciplines and agencies, is a huge focus. Specifically, as we look from birth through 8 years old, we have different infrastructure put in place. We have different systems put in place to serve children at different points, and we want to make sure that we're weaving those together very well so that we're providing families and children with continuous experiences. We can work really well together across agencies, and we've got a lot of experience doing that. Of course, Parents Aware has to work really well with scholarships, and we're working to make sure that scholarships and our CCAP program are working together to serve families and children. That's interagency work. We've built a knowledge and competency framework wherein leaders of all three agencies have come together to agree on what we think the providers and teachers who work with young children need to know to be able to work with young children most effectively. Those are forming a basis, continuing moving forward for child care aware training. We're sharing that with the higher ed community so that as we train new teachers and as we do continuing education for existing teachers, we're in alignment and we're all kind of working together on one page. That's a critical, important step toward providing continuity across sectors and also toward professionalizing the field of early childhood. We're working together on child welfare and children's mental health issues. We've worked together specifically to make sure and change agency policies to make sure that young children who are flagged as at risk or for neglect or abuse by the Department of Human Services are referred in to our State Help Me Grow system, which has been an MDE-led program. We're working together to imagine a common application system to access resources across agencies. For example, WIC, our program for women, infants, and children, and CCAP are two programs that target the same population, low-income parents of young children, for the same purposes, to help them be financially stable. There's an enormous overlap in the information we collect to qualify families for these two programs, yet because they're administered by two different agencies, they're two different applications. Add in scholarships and all the other things that we do to support families of young children, and that's a lot of work, frankly, that we're asking families to do. That's a lot of work, frankly, that we're asking state agency staff to do that we might be able to streamline better in a way that works better for us and better for families. So that's something that I'm convinced, and I think I've said this to the Education Committee before, that if all the law schools in the country can agree on one application, then we can too. And we're also working together. I mentioned Help Me Grow. We're also working together on expanding our Help Me Grow system, which currently does a phenomenal job connecting children who qualify for early childhood special education services to supportive resources. That's a phenomenal program, and our call center is getting more and more calls every month on that. Our challenge is our existing structure is capable of connecting, like I said, only the subset of children who qualify for Part B and Part C special education services with a subset of services. We're expanding that so that we can connect all children to a much wider array of services, and that's really important. The next slide shows that, and so this is the first proposal that I'm sharing with you today, and then I'm going to pass the microphone, I guess, as it is, to my colleagues in the three agencies. As Commissioner Jessen mentioned to you, our goal is we're not here presenting by agency, we're really presenting by function, because a lot of these investments across agencies really work, are designed to work complement with each other. So we're presenting like that. So please pardon any choreography hiccups, but because that's the way that we're doing this moving forward. Help Me Grow, as I mentioned, is a comprehensive collaborative system for improving access to existing resources and services for children birth to age 8 and their families. It builds on existing in-state structure. It's essentially, the goal is to build a single-door access to supports and resources across age groups, across agencies, across sectors, so that it's easier for families to access resources. We're building on existing in-state structure with help from a Help Me Grow National Center. And so that's been important as far as the technical assistance that we're able to access through the Help Me Grow National Center. And essentially, there's four core components of it. It requires a healthcare provider outreach, so that we're reaching out and really engaging healthcare providers. It involves community outreach, engaging to make sure that families and students and schools and other types of folks know that it's out there. Building a centralized access point, whether that's a phone line or online portal, to make sure that families can interface through one portal a wide array of services and resources, and data collection, so that we can know that we're using data as a flashlight, as the saying goes, to make sure that we are serving children well and building a system that works really well for all the children that we're seeking to serve. The three segments, as I showed you on that slide with the blocks, making sure that our children are healthy, making sure that our children are learning, making sure that our children are stable and in stable families. We're gonna present the proposals to you kind of in those three buckets per se. It's hard to be clean, right? Because there's not hard lines between the things that we're doing for early learning are certainly investments in family stability. The things that we're doing for family stability are certainly investments in children's health. But we're going to present first the investments that are really focused around early learning and success. We're going to talk about the investments that are focused on children's health, including mental health, and then we'll talk about some of the work that we're doing to really build strong operational community partnerships throughout the state. And so with that, I'll turn it over to Bobby Burnham from our State Department of Education, who's director of our state's Early Learning Services Division at the Department of Education, to talk about some of our high-quality early learning opportunities.
Welcome, Ms. Burnham.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. As you can see by this slide, we all know that Minnesota is working toward closing that achievement gap of children of color and children from low-income families who consistently demonstrate lower proficiency rates on key indicators such as third-grade reading. So we're really excited and to bring forth the governor's proposal. In the first piece of that proposal, again, is... What is the slide for me?
Ms. Burnham, I'm sorry, if I'll ask you to suspend for a minute. And Representative Murphy, I understand you have a question about a previous slide.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do.
I'll allow, but to the degree possible, just because of the number of members we have, if it's possible to hold your questions until the presentation's done, I would prefer that. I'll allow it. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to Mr. Carter, on slide 7, page 7, I just want to understand the data about homeless children. So there are two data points here, children with parents, and then the total count. Does the total count represent the number of homeless people on that one night, or homeless children on that one night?
Mr. Carter.
One moment, please.
Mr. Carter?
Madam Chair, Representative Murphy, thank you for the question. This is from the Wilder count. and that is the number of individuals on an average night. Children and families, yes.
And Madam Chair, just to clarify, so children with parents, 3,500 on a night, and the total count is people, adults, everybody. The 10,000 yes. represents total people.
Yes.
Individuals. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes.
Thank you, Ms. Burnham. I appreciate your flexibility. And go ahead and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So right now, we know that too many children are entering kindergarten unprepared to learn. And under the governor's proposal, an estimated 31,000 students would gain access to free, all-day, high-quality pre-K, giving them the excellent start they need to succeed in school. This would build on the progress of the over 9,000 early learning scholarships currently being implemented with the governor and legislated funding over the last several years. So we know that intensive, high-quality pre-kindergarten programs can close much of the early achievement gap for low-income children. This substantially increases their school success and produces a host of lifelong benefits, including increased school achievement and social and economic success as adults. The governor proposal requires a high level of quality that is shown to have the most impact on these highest needs children. Implementing a high-quality pre-kindergarten statewide will give school districts an intentional pathway to support their community's youngest learners by partnering with community-based providers to align curriculum, assessments, instruction, and professional development, not just in pre-kindergarten, but along the pre-K through third grade learning continuum. This will also provide the opportunity to engage with and prepare families prior to school entry and support districts as they work to effectively implement the world's best workforce legislation as well as the LEAPS legislation. Compelling research shows that the years between pre-kindergarten and third grade creates the foundation for school achievement in later years. Several longitudinal studies on high-quality pre-K through third grade alignment show that children who participated in these programs had a lower referral and service rates for special ed, reduced behavior issues, higher overall school attendance, improved test scores, and higher graduation rates, as well as lower rates of incarceration. When schools link high-quality pre-K education to elementary grades, creating a common organizational structure and common sets of academic and social goals, the gains that children make in pre-K are likely to persist through their elementary school years. The second proposal that the governor's budget brings forth is eliminating or working to eliminate the Head Start wait list. As we know, Head Start promotes school readiness for low-income children by enhancing their cognitive, social, and emotional development and by providing their families health, education, nutritional, and other social services. Governor Dayton's proposal would promote school readiness, family support, and education for low-income children. While 12,070 children currently benefit from the Head Start services last year, there are 2,484 children still on the wait list. So Governor Dayton's $19.4 million investment would work toward eliminating the wait list and ensure no child is denied services. The Minnesota Reading Corps is a highly effective program that provides trained tutors for students who are struggling with their literacy skills. The governor's budget would invest an additional $10 million in the program, focusing resources on the years pre-K through first grade. The Reading Corps program would be able to grow from 1,200 to almost 1,700 AmeriCorps members and increase the number of children served to 44,000 each year. A recently completed multi-year external evaluation by the University of Chicago validates the effectiveness of the Minnesota Reading Corps pre-kindergarten program as an effective model for improving preschool students' emergent literacy skills. And in addition, the program is highly replicable in multiple settings and across student characteristics.
Madam Chair, members, listen to Justin again. So the next three bullets are really talking about improvements to our child care assistance program, which is run by the Department of Human Services. And just as a refresher, this provides child care both for children whose families are on our NFIP, our Welfare to Work program, or transitioning off that program. And those children are kind of basically entitled to this benefit under certain circumstances. But there's also what we call our basic sliding fee program, which is available to working families, working poor families, based on a, you know, sliding scale payments. But there is a long wait list, over 6,000 families in the wait list for that program. So what this proposal will do, three things. First of all, it would simplify it would make it easier to get for all children who are eligible to get onto those programs and to stay on. And the reason it's a very complicated system today, and that's because we've made our child care, the eligibility for child care assistance for kids dependent upon when their mom or dad is working or in school or doing job searches. And this is you know, part of kind of the welfare reform efforts that the state did, and in very much successfully in many ways back in the 1990s. But what we did was link the ability to get child care to the hours a mom or dad is working. And what that means is that for these parents who are in these low-income jobs where sometimes their hours change, their hours of work change, or they change jobs, and what it means then for that child is suddenly their eligibility for child care changes. It also makes it much harder for child care providers who are kind of constantly having to figure out if they're eligible for the CCAP. So this would really streamline it and make the child care assistance eligibility more based on the child's needs as opposed to the mom or dad's work schedules. So that is the first one. It would benefit, we think, about 700 children. The second part is to at least reduce the waiting list for the basic sliding fee list, and that would be, I think, very significant for children, for families, for counties, for providers. Most of these dollars would go for children under five. We've targeted there, and it would be additional funding for the counties with the longest waiting lists. And the third part of the governor's proposal is to make sure that we're not just having kids in child care, but that wherever possible, it's quality child care. Melvin Carter talked about the Race to the Top grant, which really enabled us to start taking our parent aware rating system, which now any family can go to the parent aware website and find out if their child care provider is rated, and which is a benefit, I think, for all Minnesota families and builds upon some of the work through you know, really in our private partnership, public partnership from, you know, 2007, 2008, when there were four pilots. But it's especially important for poor children who are either entitled to the scholarships the legislature made available or in our CCAP program, because if they can, if they go and choose, if those families choose in CCAP, for an example, a provider that's three or four star rated in parent aware, one, they know their kids are going to be much, much more likely to be ready for kindergarten. I visited some of these providers, and it's just amazing the work they're able to do. But it costs money to build that infrastructure, both, especially when you're talking about family child care, which is the backbone of our system, and to make sure that those providers are getting the training and the help and the curriculum to really help the kids be ready for kindergarten. But we also provided incentives. So for providers that are three or four star rated, they get more money from our CCAP program. This would be able, would really sustain that rating system, so that our goal is by the middle of 2016, 40% of the children in our CCAP program are in quality rated programs.
So, Madam Chair and committee members, we're looking also to, in the governor's proposal, to remember that it's a comprehensive package, and statewide pre-K, of course, would work in tandem with the Early Learning Scholarship Program, providing parents with a wide array of educational opportunities for their children. So we're looking at enhancing the portability of those scholarships and increasing family choice and expanding from being only having three- and four-year-olds eligible to having birth through age five eligible for early learning scholarships. Yes, and then another exciting opportunity in the governor's proposal is investing in school nutrition. We all know school nutrition matters. Last year, the governor and legislature invested new resources in school nutrition to ensure that every student receives a healthy lunch. That new investment also provided free breakfast for all kindergarten students in Minnesota. And now, when students have a healthy meal in school, we know that discipline referrals have gone down by 50%. Healthy meals lead to improved student attention, a reduction in visits to the school nurse, and better test scores. So right now, only 39% of all elementary age students participate in the school breakfast program. And that is why the governor's budget would invest another $28.1 million to ensure every child from pre-K through third grade has access to a well-rounded nutritionist meal to start their day.
I just want to say a couple of words about the Oral Health Initiative. You know, overall, our public programs, medical assistance, and Minnesota Care do a good job making sure that children on them get quality health care. But we have a real gap when it comes to dental care. And that's not because when they get it, it's not good care overall. But we have real gaps in access. And this is especially throughout our state, but especially in greater Minnesota. So for kids in our state, only 30% of them have the preventive dental work that they need. 30%, that's 10% lower than the national average of 40%, and 40% is nothing to be proud of. So the governor's budget proposes to increase the rates to dental providers and make some other adjustments to try and make sure that more dentists are signing up to take our public program enrollees. Next, if I may, Madam Chair, members, let me say a few words about the child protection proposals in the governor's budget. I'm co-chairing, and I see several members here, on the governor's child protection task force. The task force made some initial recommendations by the end of last year. There'll be a full report by the end of March, but some of the initial recommendations were to asking the department to increase the oversight and supervision of counties, as well as to provide more training for county workers, for mandated reporters, and others. And so this really funds those initial recommendations, so the department is in a position to do that. And we look forward to hopefully coming back with you when we have a fuller set of recommendations. Sorry, the next one is mine as well. In the governor's budget overall, we, after children, from a DHS perspective, mental health is the second kind of major thing that we are focused on, and particularly when it comes to improving access to our mental health system and for children. So let me just address a couple of things here, which I think work well with the other initiatives we've gone through. You know, first is, and this is one that really starts in the next biennium that we wanted to be ready for it, is to build, to give funding to the collaboratives, which are around our state, which do good work, to really do much more training to be able to reduce the incidence of adverse childhood experiences. This is very much a public health approach and an interest we share with the Department of Health. The second one is to expand respite care for children, for families whose children have serious mental illness around the state. We have some funding for this, but if we could give more respite grants through the counties to families in need, we would have fewer out-of-home placements. I think we'd have more stable families. These are parents who are trying to take care of really some challenging situations, and if we can give them some respite care, we're going to be able to keep those families together longer. And we'd also be studying whether we could make this a Medicaid benefit. We also have a proposal for mental health consultation for early childhood providers. As many of you all recall, a couple of years ago, and this is very much a bipartisan effort, I believe, that we to double the number of school-length mental health grants in our schools, so that at schools we're able to kind of identify when kids need help, to screen and to get them the help that they need. We're able to reach, you know, so many children that otherwise wouldn't have come to the attention of our mental health system until much later when they were in a crisis. But we believe that if we can extend this to early childhood providers, that we will catch children who are beginning to experience problems and get them help even sooner. And just talking with child care providers, you know, they talk about the challenges, the mental health challenges, very early on that they see, but they're not equipped always to deal with them. And to have someone who's specialized in mental health and early childhood as a consultant, to be able to consult with the provider and make referrals to our mental health system, we think would be a real benefit. And the next bullet is about, I think, an exciting pilot, very collaborative effort between law enforcement as well as education and the Department of Human Services. And this would be to have a pilot in three schools to work on the problem of students who have often some, really difficult behavioral situations where they are often just a pipeline to the corrections department in the juvenile justice system, and to see if we can work with law enforcement to identify them earlier, to have interventions, and to really establish a middle Minnesota model for kind of dealing with those children where we can in the mental health system and divert some of those referrals to the corrections department. And finally on this page, a major part of our mental health initiative is to establish a new level of psychiatric residential treatment for children. This is some work we've really done with MGE as well, and some of the intermediate school districts and others who have told us, and we certainly see this, there are probably between 300 and 400 children every year with serious mental health problems and sometimes some very aggressive, self-injurious behaviors, that we don't have the level of treatment for them in this state. And some of those kids, and sometimes it's the schools that end up sending them even out of state to get this level of treatment. So we're proposing a new level of treatment. It would have to be, approved by CMS, but to have this new psychiatric residential level of care that's a step beyond what our current residential children's mental health providers are able to provide. We think that would be a tremendous benefit with some of these very hard-to-serve children.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Maggie Diebel. I'm the Director of the Community and Family Health Division at the Minnesota Department of Health. And I'm going to talk about evidence-based family home visiting. The governor is proposing $2.65 million in the next biennium and $2 million a year thereafter to support our family home visiting programs. Research has shown, I think as many of you may know, that 80% of brain development occurs before age 3 and is shaped by a child's early experiences, including what happens prenatally. Our evidence-based home visiting programs have been shown to be successful in mitigating the impact of adverse experiences such as poverty, maltreatment, and other trauma. I think we've heard a lot today about what happens in a child's early life. And this proposal will expand the state's current evidence-based home visiting program through competitive awards to community health boards and tribal nations, providing services to an additional number of families. I'm going to amend the number that you see up there on the slide. With $2 million in the out years, we think that we could actually double the number that you see up there of families being served from perhaps 400 to 600 families in addition to the families we're serving now. Our current programs include the Nurse Family Partnership, Healthy Families America, and the Family Home Visiting Program, which is a program that is culturally tailored for American Indian families. Family home visiting is really a voluntary home-based service, ideally provided prenatally, as I mentioned, through the early years of a child's life. Services are provided by nurses or highly trained home visitors. And here is a list of all of the services that are providing, develops parent knowledge of child development, enhances parenting behaviors, and what is that really critical parent-child relationship. We know that that relationship that really fosters, and here we're talking about good infant mental health that can really set the stage for kids being ready to learn when they get to school age and for meeting all of those key developmental milestones. So the home visitors are there to really support the parents in helping the children to
to succeed. So other things that they can do increases parents' confidence and skills in this regard, screening for risk factors that might put these kids at risk, and then be able to ensure that they get access to all the services that we're talking about here today, including connects to preventive health services. And then they do other things to help the families be safe in a home environment, including things like preventing exposure to environmental hazards. There really has been a lot of evidence to show that evidence-based home visiting programs work. They improve healthy birth outcomes, again, use of those preventive health services, and reduced ER visits. The research has shown that there's up to a $5.70 return on investment in government programs. There was a Minnesota study done not long ago that shows by a child's 18th birthday that we can save as much as $3,000 to $4,000 of investment using a nurse family partnership. So things like child maltreatment, juvenile arrest, maternal convictions, emergency department use, and cognitive and behavioral problems experienced by kids are all mitigated by family home visiting services. With that, I'll turn it back.
Thank you. And Madam Chair, members of the committee, one important aspect that we have to understand, obviously, that the state, while the state provides resources and administrates programs, we have administers programs, that we have to be partners with local providers, local communities, to make sure that we are really building routes and making sure that the experience of local providers and local leaders on the ground across our state is effectively being able to take those and bundle them for the unique communities that they serve. And so the next section that we want to just talk about is some of the far-reaching community partnerships that we're working to build with the state and the ones that we're working to support.
Madam Chair, committee members, I think you've heard from all of us sitting here today the importance of linking systems and collaboration and comprehensive services. And the first proposal in the governor's budget is to increase funding for two really strong exemplary examples of those community partnerships, that being the NAS and St. Paul Promise neighborhood. The governor's budget would provide increase in funding for wraparound services for children and families within the NAS and St. Paul Promise neighborhoods. Both programs currently partner with families and the community to work towards closing the achievement gap. The proposal would provide an increase of $1 million to each of these communities, and the funds would be used to reduce multi-generational poverty and address the academic achievement gap.
Madam Chair and members, the next provision really comes from our efforts at DHS to where tribal governments are willing and able to take over some or all of their human services programs, to really work with them to be able to do that. I mean, we would still kind of oversee and have a supervisory role in many respects. But this really came out, we started doing this in our child welfare area, and what we've seen is that where the tribes have couple of them started administering their own child welfare programs in often a more culturally appropriate way, and building upon their relationships, we got better outcomes for those kids. We saw fewer out-of-home placements. And so we have here one tribe that wants to extend that. It was already authorized in 2011. I saw Jim Abler here earlier. It was one of his, something he worked hard on, as I recall, with the White Earth Nation, to say we're ready. We believe that if we are able to administer our own human services programs, that we'll be able to get better outcomes for our kids. And we have the greatest disparity, some of the greatest disparities with tribal members, and we think this is a good direction to go for the tribes that are willing and able to do so. We think White Earth is, but there's some initial, you know, funding and infrastructure that we need to build to be able to do that. And Red Lake is interested in doing the same sort of thing with their TANF program, so this provides some kind of startup funding and planning of dollars so that they can at least start looking at that direction as well. We also propose in the governor's budget, and this is really related to some of the challenges in our child welfare system, an American Indian Family Early Intervention Program. So this would be funding that would go for American Indian families, and we'd be working with the tribes on this, for families which, you know, they're not screened in. They're not in the child welfare system, but they are really at risk. And we know they're at risk, and we want to intervene earlier before they end up in that system. This is an evidence-based program we do often with the counties, and we've seen good outcomes. We want to do it with the tribes. Once again, we know that American Indian children are much more likely to end up in our child protection system and in out-of-home placements, and this is an effort to really try and to start to turn that around. And finally, the investment in targeted coordinated program for pregnant mothers. This is one of the things we're trying to do to address what is really a troubling statistic. So over 3 years, we saw the number of babies that were born, and after they were born, they were going through withdrawal from opiates. Think of like addicted babies. We saw that number almost double in our state. And it's particularly a problem close to some of the reservations and in some of and in parts of our cities. So this is really an effort to say we want to, and we'd be working closely with the tribes on part of this as well, and they recognize this is a concern. We want to do more to identify earlier opiate-dependent, you know, pregnant women who are opiate-dependent and work with them during their pregnancy, you know, make the appropriate referrals, the follow-up, you know, bridge some of those cultural gaps, make sure they get into the system of care, get the help and treatment help they need. Good for those moms, but especially good for those babies. This is something that costs a little money in the first biennium, but has savings because, as you can imagine, there are a lot of savings if you're not paying those hospital bills for the neonatal units, and just mostly if you think of the savings of children that don't go through with these the after effects of this through their lives.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, again, Melvin Carter, Director of the State's Office of Early Learning. Thank you very much. We want to thank you for your time. We thank you for your interest. Just the fact of pulling together these two committees to have this discussion together, I think is critical, as a critical start in terms of the context of the interagency, the aligned work that we've discussed the need for. I want to share with you that this represents the overview of the governor's budget proposal as regards, as it relates to young children, and reiterate those goals. Is one, build a robust system that can serve different families and different children in different parts of the state really well with different options to really drive equity by making sure that we have the opportunity to target and know where we can focus our work most effectively for results. And with the understanding that across and within every sector and every agency, every age group, we have to be really focused on aligning our efforts and making it more accessible and convenient for families to access everything that we do. And that's how I think we transform our state through investments in young children. That's our complete presentation, and then I think we'll stand for questions if there's any.
Thank you. I have a number of members on the list, but first I understand that Mr. Koffel may have a clarifying statement on the question on homelessness that was brought up earlier. So why don't we do that first?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I was hoping he might.
Thank you. Mr. Koppel, please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Jim Koppel. I'm the Assistant Commissioner in the Department of Human Services for Children and Family Services. And I apologize for not having all the numbers ready for that question. On that particular slide, there are 3,546 homeless children. And this is a census count on a per night in shelters. Then you add to that, there are 1,100 homeless youth, 1,150 homeless youth, and then you get to a total of 10,214, which would include those children, those homeless youth, the parents, and then other adults. So I just, to be clear, and then to focus on those children of the 3,516 or 3,546 children, half of those are under the age of five.
Right. thank you very much. We appreciate that clarification. All right. I have first on the list Representative Franzen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the testifiers, and I'm not sure who wants to take it, but thank you all for being here. Could you, maybe the commissioner could, Commissioner Justin, how does putting stars behind someone's name guarantee child care? This is relating to parent aware.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Franzen, I don't think stars guarantee child care. I think the stars are, what the stars will tell you is that that provider has been through some pretty rigorous training and has supports and has a curriculum they're using that's evidence-based to, you know, that shows that kids in those programs are much more likely to be ready for kindergarten. But it is not a guarantee of anything, Representative Franzen.
Follow-up, Representative Franzen?
I have quite a few.
Go ahead.
Thank you. Commissioner Justin, so it's called a quality rating system for a reason, correct? And so if we're putting stars behind a child care provider's name and it doesn't indicate exactly quality, then why do we have a quality rating system?
Commissioner Justin.
Madam Chair, Representative Franzen, I do believe the stars indicate quality. When you'd asked earlier if it guarantees, I would stop short of saying it guarantees, but it's a an evidence-based, pretty rigorous quality rating system that we administer, both for child care centers as well as for family daycare.
Representative Franzen.
Commissioner Justin, would you be able to tell the committee where the accountability is after a provider receives a star rating?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Franzen, you know, at the Department of Human Services, we administer the quality rating program. You know, there is ongoing oversight to it. It's not a one-time thing. It also, quality rating can also be given based upon, you know, at least in part upon accreditation by national for child care centers. So there are a number of ways that kind of we have ongoing oversight of the quality rating system.
Representative?
Thank you. So Commissioner Justin, I've been getting a lot of feedback from providers all over the state, and one of the concerns that they have about the program, along with many, because there's, I could talk all day about this program, that there really is no accountability. You could get a star, but there's no guarantee that that provider is actually doing what that star is telling the parents that they're doing, okay, that there's no accountability. No one really knows what those best if those best practices for kindergarten readiness are being used according to the Parent Aware program. Basically, it's the honor system. Would you agree with that?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Franzen, I think that we have oversight that is beyond an honor system, though can I say I do think, you know, a number of our healthcare providers are very honorable. It's not that I would not question that. You know, we have had, Madam Chair, Representative Franzen, you know, a real increase in the number of providers that have stepped up to go through the training, which isn't an easy thing to do. It does take time and a real commitment. And I think the fact that they're willing to take that time and commitment means that they see it as being valuable for the kids they're serving.
Representative Franzen.
Some of the providers have indicated the fact that it is actually a huge investment of time and they actually don't see the benefits in it, and that just some providers have actually just faked their way through and then at the end of the program have just sold their stuff and closed their business down. So, all right, let's refocus here. There's currently 1,892 Parent Aware rated providers statewide, correct?
Commissioner.
That is correct. Okay. Madam Chair, Representative, that is correct.
Representative Branson.
And the latest numbers that I received from the Department of Human Services says that we have, with centers included, family, child care, and centers, there is 11,384 providers throughout the state of Minnesota. you might not know those numbers.
I don't know.
But so that is only 16% of the providers across the entire state of Minnesota that is participating, center and home-based. So today I just thought, well, I'll just see how many providers in my zip code that I live in are actually participating. And so I just printed off the list. It's many pages of providers. This includes the centers. And there's 95 providers in my zip code of 56308. Of those providers, there are three centers that are 4 stars. One home provider with 4 stars. One center with 2 stars. One home provider with 2 stars. One center with 1 star. And 2 home providers that are in process. So out of 95, quick math, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 86 providers have not participated in this program. So I'm just wondering, what is the goal of Parent Aware? And we've had this program in place for a few years now. And so it doesn't seem like the providers themselves want to participate in Parent Aware. So I'm just wondering, what does the department think about that?
Commissioner Jackson.
Madam Chair, Representative Franson. This has been a program that's only been in place a few years, and we are seeing an increasing number of providers, start the process of being training, of getting rated. It is, which I think goes to your point earlier, it is a voluntary system. Providers don't have to participate in Parent Aware. If they are concerned about it being a waste of time, it's not a requirement. But we are seeing increased numbers participate, and the value of it, we think, is it's not that you can certainly have, and I know that there are a number of providers, and my kids were all in family child care, that provided quality child care without being Parent Aware rated, I think you're far more likely to make sure, if you're a parent, that you're getting that quality ready for kindergarten experience if it's in a rated program.
Representative Franson.
Well, the reason why I ask Commissioner Jessen is because there is a proposal that I'm not sure if the bill has been introduced, but it is being talked about tying child care assistance with having those children go to a rated program. And so my concern is that it's going to lead to even more lack of access for the lower income children to go into homes. And so while Parent Aware may not be forced, it may be being able to just willingly do this program, my concern is that when you tie the child care assistance program to Parent Aware, we're going to have more of a shortage of child care providers even participating, and those children are going to be left with no options to go.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Franson, that I understand there are proposals out there. That's certainly not part of the governor's budget proposal. And I do think that we both share kind of wanting to have more kids have access to our CCAP program. So I certainly share that concern.
Representative? Thank you. Representative
Hertas. Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is maybe a little bit of a segue on to Representative Franson's. My question is around the high-quality early learning also. And in the slide 2 of that section, it states as a goal is to provide voluntary full-day high-quality pre-K for four-year-olds statewide. And we have initiated this rating system. And we've provided scholarships for Pathway 1 and Pathway 2. And in your presentation, you made reference to partnering with local providers. And the governor's proposal commits a fairly substantial amount of money in this area. And I was wondering if you could be a little more clear on what partnering with local providers means with regard to the governor's proposal. And is this really a commitment to Pathway 1 scholarships?
Who wants to take that one? Ms. Burnham?
Madam Chair, Representative, the mixed delivery system is a system that is being implemented in several states around universal pre-K. And the intent of the mixed delivery system is to offer parents a choice. And the way that we are proposing the state pre-K model would be to, of course, since the funding is part of the formula, school districts would be the fiscal host. And due to any potential number of, so if a school district had facility challenges, then they would be encouraged to reach out to their community partners to partner with them, whether it be a Head Start, a center-based. So that's where the mixed delivery comes in. So the district would then partner with the Head Start, center-based, whatever private provider is able to meet the state program criteria. So the district would contract with those providers, and they would be expected to adhere to the same level of high-quality criteria as the school-based programs.
Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, there seems to be significant data that suggests that for the money that we've spent, both federal resources and state resources, in developing an early care system throughout the state with private providers, that the cost and delivery of that system, these folks were promised if they met rating systems and graduate into it that they're going to be supported in this, and it seems like now we're making a commitment to really compete with the very system that private enterprise, which is about a $3.1 billion industry in Minnesota, creating really a myriad of access and choice throughout the entire state. Now it sounds like we're going to go into competition with those very same folks and expand the reach of public education. Is this really the best use of the resources to serve the greatest number of Minnesotans?
Ms. Burnham.
Madam Chair, Representative, it's not meant to be a competitive, it's meant to be a partnership. It's about linking systems. It's about linking the school-based system with the community-based system in partnership, because it's not saying one is better than the other. It's having consistency across all program types, so no matter what program a four-year-old goes to, they're going to arrive at kindergarten being provided the same high-quality services no matter what program it is. So it's not about competition, it's about linking systems and partnerships.
I'll yield. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. I want to thank the testifiers, especially Director Carter and Commissioner Jessen. I know your intentions are extremely good. When I look at the governor's proposal, I do agree with parts of it. I like the Minnesota Reading Corps, to mention one. I understand the nutritional part of it, to mention another, just to mention a couple. But I do question some of the rest of it. And what I mean by that is you've done a good job of defining the problems, okay? And it seems like things are getting worse rather than better in many cases. But last year I was on the K-12 Finance Committee, which Representative Mark Court chaired and did an excellent job. And he tended to let me say what I wanted to say, no. Which maybe he regrets at this point. But anyway, Representative Pam Myra is on that committee, and I, you know, of all the representatives that I'm aware of, she did extensive study on early childhood programs from Head Start to other programs, and looked at the research, went to meetings, and she consistently came back with that these pre-K programs, although there's an initial benefit to them, by the fifth or sixth grade, and this is off the top of my head, most of the benefit wears off. In terms of Head Start, there's been national studies done that show the same thing. One of my experts that I reference is Dr. John Brewer. Back in the late 1990s, he was on President Clinton's Council for Early Childhood Education. He was the only one to vote against the recommendations of that national council. Dr. Brewer is eminently well qualified to comment on early childhood, He wrote a book, The Myth of the First 3 Years. You can find it on the internet and order it. I have. And basically, you know, Dr. Brewer has established the McConnell Pew Program in Cognitive Neuroscience, a new mind-brain science that links neuroscience and psychology to the study of human cognition. He also developed the Cognitive Study for Educational Practices, supports application of cognitive science to improve educational outcomes, to just to name a few of his accomplishments. So he puts into question much of the so-called research to justify the expenditures of these millions and even billions of dollars nationwide on early childhood and whether or not they're going to produce long-term beneficial results, especially on the achievement gap. Last session at the Educational Committee, I also presented 2 studies. One showed that if children were raised in a traditional two-parent family, 90% of child poverty would be eliminated in our state and across the nation. Another study from the University of California showed that if children are raised in a two-parent traditional family, the achievement gap would not only be reduced, it would be eliminated just by having them raised in a two-parent family. And finally, I would say that in terms of the reading literacy problem, I agree there's a huge problem. I did jail ministry for 13 years. Jail ministry. I wasn't in jail, by the way. I did jail ministry for 13 years, and when we used to go around and read, guess what most of the prisoners couldn't do very well? They couldn't read. So a huge contributing problem to our prison population is the ability to not read properly. Okay? I link that.
Representative Grenhagen, so you know, I've got like probably 12 members on the list, so if you could get to your question, I'm sorry, I hate to cut you off. But
you sound like my wife, to tell you the truth. I'm just about there, okay? unless they ask me to repeat everything. No, what I found is that the promotion of whole language and basal literature in our public schools is, along with inventive spelling and creative writing, causes the majority of reading problems. Instead of teaching intensive systematic phonics, traditional spelling, and the teaching of grammar. So the point is, when I look at the governor's budget, I see much of the money is being what I consider to be misdirected in an area that is not going to result in solutions to the problems you so eloquently defined, and that money should be redirected towards support of the traditional family and emphasizing reading curriculums that actually have empirical evidence that work, rather than the whole language hoax that's currently being promoted to our children in the inner city and public schools across this state and nation. Would you care to respond to that?
Who wants to take a crack? Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Grenhagen, let me at least address the pre-K part. You know, and I'll defer on the broader education comments to the Department of Education. And I haven't read the studies you referred to, but I wrote the names down, and I'll go and look them up. But I have been really heartened by the important work done here, led by Art Rolnick, about just this showing the value, just even if you're just looking at dollars, of investing in pre-kindergarten, and that has really, you know, been very important, I think, to me. I know to the governor. Now, that's not to say I kind of read his article in the Post today. I mean, I know Art Rolnick would have different priorities, perhaps, but I think the research that he talks about the importance of pre-K is very evidence-based. But I will look at the articles that you reference.
Thank you.
Ms. Burnham?
Madam Chair, Representative, thank you for your comments. I think a couple things. I think it's important to remember that the reason we're all sitting up here in a united front is that we are addressing a 0 to age 8 comprehensive early learning system. And you made mention of what we call the fade-out effect. So part of our priority as a coordinated system is to address the needs from birth through grade 3. So part of that is looking at ensuring high quality and alignment persists from the preschools through the pre-K through grade kindergarten on up. So that's part of our responsibility to work with districts and programs to ensure that level of quality. And I think the literacy, we feel strongly in the legislation around Read Well by Third Grade and the work that districts are doing with their local literacy plans. And we continue to work with districts to even think adding that pre-K, that four-year-old, into that mix so they're thinking comprehensively, whether it's literacy, math, social, emotional, across that 0 to 8 learning domain and guarantee that level of quality through third grade. And that is going to reduce or maybe even eliminate that fade-out effect you're referring to.
Mr. Carter?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Grunhagen. I appreciate the comment because it's really it really highlights exactly what we're saying, which is that all things have to work together in alignment. As Ms. Burnham just pointed out, we certainly know that third grade reading is really a critical benchmark, and we know that children who are not ready to read at grade level by the end of third grade are most likely never going to catch up. There are exceptions, but that's the real kind of place that we really need to be focused on. We know that children who are ready for kindergarten are much more likely to be reading at grade level by third grade, but that's not without additional investment. To me, the statement that the benefits of Head Start fade out is an acknowledgement that Head Start has some strong benefits, and that's true. I think there has to be some continued investments in children as we move forward, and those investments, like we talked about, have to be aligned across ages. The other thing I would say is, so when we talk about all the investments that we're doing to make sure that children are ready for kindergarten, it has to be followed up, you're absolutely right, with additional investments to make sure that we maintain the advantage that we gain. It also has to be preceded, which is why we're focusing on babies and children. And I'd point you back to the Ms. Thiebel's presentation about evidence-based family home visiting, which has actually been proven to reduce that fade-out effect as well.
Thank you. Representative Mullery.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Well, first of all, even though he's not here, I think really want to thank the governor for such a huge commitment to early childhood, which is our future as a state. And it's amazing that he's really taken such a great commitment on that area. I do hope before this session ends, as we're shifting money around, that he gets some of his advisors get a little more into looking into the national research on where to put the money. And for instance, I was just in November, I was at the White House with about 10 others from around the country and met with the Linda and Libby Show, the two top people, and Linda Smith and Libby Daggett, two top advisors to the president on early childhood. And they are actually moving most of their money out of four-year-olds because it's not as important and moving it into 0 to 3, they said. And I wanted to make sure that I did that, so I dug out my notes last night on that from that meeting. And then I got the same thing the next day at Johns Hopkins, which is now considered even apparently better than Harvard for early childhood research, even though Jack Schoenkopf, of course, is still the guru. But he says the same thing. Everybody at Hopkins said 0 to 3, not 4. Jack is really pushing that. By the way, he brought up Commissioner Art Rolnick. He just contacted me a couple weeks ago, and I didn't see his article, but he told me he was supporting the 0 to 3 strongly. But one thing that they specifically brought up, and I have a question for here, is that's something we hope you start moving the money. Keep the money in. The governor's committed huge amount of money, which is incredibly great. The home visiting, first of all, does the feds pay half or what on our present home visiting program? The expansion you have here, will they pay? And when I was meeting with Linda's, she's the one that's head of human services there. is she said they were shifting into home visiting. They consider so important. They're shifting a lot of money into that. Are you considering what might be coming? I suppose it hasn't. I haven't been up to date since mid-November on what's happening on that. Do you know whether there's more money going to come to us? How, or is that included in this, or just what is federal now, what is possible federal in the future on this, and if we can get federal, can you put more money total into home visiting? Sorry, there's about four questions.
Madam Chair, Representative Mueller, I'm going to defer to Director Diebel on the specific questions about home visiting, but I did want to say I don't think that you have anybody on this panel of testifiers who would disagree with the importance of 0 to 3. I think what we would say is that doesn't make four-year-olds unimportant or five-year-olds unimportant or prenatal care unimportant, but that we're really building a system that, like that chain link fence is only as strong as its weakest link, and that we have to make sure that we're balancing our investments kind of across that system, across the ages, to make sure that we are investing early and getting our children all off to the great start that we know that they need to succeed in school and in life. You're right when you say family home visiting really makes a difference where 0 to 3 is concerned. The increased flexibility that we're adding for early learning scholarships will allow those scholarships program, which has been really focused on 3 and 4 year olds, to be utilized by younger and younger children to affect that. And so you'll probably be pleased to know that the folks who are advising the governor are aware of that research and that is reflected in these proposals. With that, I'll defer to Director Diebel on the specific questions about home visiting.
Madam Chair, Representative Mulry, yes, we currently do get federal funding. This is through the what's called the MICV program. It's the Maternal Infant Early Childhood Home Visiting programs. We get two streams of money. One is a formula-based grant that goes out to all states. We get $1.25 million annually. That ends in September of 2016. We also get a competitive grant, and that amounts to $7.2 million annually. That expires in March 2015. You may be aware that the appropriation for that expired in October of last year. They extended the appropriation for 6 months and provided some bridge funding to states. Then Congress is going to take it up again in March. So we'll know then whether or not there will be additional appropriations. What we know about the bridge funding was that, well, we there was a competitive process. We did submit an application. A number of states will be awarded up to $9.4 million for a period of 2 years and 7 months. So we're not sure whether we will be awarded a grant, whether it will be at that $9.4 million level. What we do know is that money is considerably less annually than we're currently receiving.
Representative Mullen.
Madam Chair, so even if with their new money that she said they were going to put in, we'd be receiving less? Mm-hmm.
Well, again, this is just the, Madam Chair, Representative, this is just the bridge funding for that six-month period that I'm talking about. We don't know whether there will be an additional appropriation in March. That's something we're waiting to see.
Madam
Chair, one more question. Linda also brought up, or was it Libby brought up, Minnesota was applying for some grant thing that December 10th, I think, was the date on. Mm-hmm. Was that the thing where we applied for money for this universal four-year-old? Is that
Ms. Byrne.
The one?
Madam Chair, Representative, yes. Minnesota was eligible to compete in the expansion, preschool development expansion grant, solely because we were a race to the top state. We were competing against other states who have fairly robust four-year-old pre-K programs, and we submitted a proposal as to how we would build the system or enhance the current system, but we did not receive the grant And the states who did receive were several of the Race to the Top, or several states who had not received Race to the Top money yet, so we feel that was a priority. We also feel that because we are in the expansion category rather than the development category, we would have been a better fit for the development category. So we feel that that maybe hurt us a little bit in that competition.
Representative Mallory.
So that's the one where we came out 16th of 18 or something like that? Is that the same grant proposal?
You know, I don't have those specifics stats, but I could certainly let you know where we came. It was in that the two one. Levels of competition, yeah.
Thank you. Representative Kwan.
Thank you, Madam and Mr. Chair, and I want to thank the Commissioner and the testifiers. This is a, you know, there's quite a bit of effort, an obvious production value in this presentation. I'm a bit disappointed because this is an important issue. And when we, you know, have some cutesy type presentation things, you know, with the cars, kids aren't objects. They're human beings. And they're individuals. They're not numbers. And, you know, I like numbers. And I do have some concerns with the numbers on 8. It seems as if 5, 4, 3, 2, 1 is a little too either rounded and truncated to fit. Gee, it looks nice to present, but you know, as is stated, the American Indian children have a lot of issues and problems overcoming. There's been, I think, in some ways, there's a higher achievement gap, and it doesn't seem to be represented in this. So that if we could actually get the real numbers that aren't truncated, and also the components that are in there. When you say challenges, because a lot of things come up as challenges to kids, and it'd be nice to have that. Looking through this, I do see some things I like. I mean, I do believe in eliminating the Head Start wait list because, frankly, we're seeing great things out of some of these programs. But too often, it seems like we're aiming at a universal global situation. I really appreciate classroom time in front of teachers, but I also appreciate mother-child time. And it seems as if you know, this is aiming to you know, push something in between, and instead of being a partner and assisting and augmenting, in some ways it looks like it, we're thinking that government's better than that relationship, and there are a lot of nurturing parents who have done a great job, and having an adult involved is key to success. And it was touched upon, frankly, it's not just poverty, it's two-parent household. If you're a single parent, you have so many things going on and bandwidth, and I'd like to make sure that we assist on that basis too for availability for these programs. And then we're talking about moving some of the pre-K in to schools. Will the schools have to abide by the same guidelines, rules, and regulations that the licensed daycares do? Because it's different. I know there's in transportation, there are some big concerns that are going to pop up because there are rules for four-year-olds that don't quite fit into some of the forgiveness we've given in transportation of older children. And so this is such a key thing. I would like to find out, you know, there was a comment, discipline's been cut in half. And that was packaged in with the breakfasts and the lunches. And frankly, I remember in education, the commissioner of education presented that there was an effort because they felt there were some discrepancies and disparity in suspensions and discipline, and they went through and did some programs that decreased
by about half the disciplines in order to take care of some disparities. So I would think that might be more contributing to that type of comment or stat that was in the presentation, especially since you said there were only 39% partaking of the free breakfast, which would be hard to explain a 50% change. But it all comes down to these are kids, they're individuals, they're families, and the parents are key to their success. So whatever we implement, it has to be a partnership, assistance, and a help to those parents, and not make them think as if they're not important because they're not doing the job and government is.
Right, because, Kwan, thanks. I'm going to allow the testifiers if they want to make comment, and then we'll need to move on.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Kwan, and let me just start. Thanks for your comments just on the presentation. We'll step back and take a look at that. The last thing I want to do is make anyone think that we're thinking of children as numbers, because that's not our intent, so I'll take a look at that. And as far as the more data around this challenge slide, I'll have our staff reach out and get that. We have a lot more data, and yes, this is a simplistic way to look at it. There was so much time, and we'll certainly get that to you. And can I just say on the importance of families, the importance especially of parents, you know, I couldn't agree more. You know, we're not... and maybe I just should have, you know, started out by saying something about this, but I'm looking at kind of two of my members of the Child Protection Task Force, Representative Bichette and Representative Mullery, and I think that just certainly looking at that and looking at that world tells you just how critical to children's growing up, you know, those stable family is, that critical relationship with a parent. And I certainly understand that. And that anything we do, if it's not in partnership with families, you know, it's not going to work the best for kids.
Mr. Carter.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Representative Kwan, thank you. And I'm sure Director Burnham would love to speak to the differences in expectations with schools and license the child care. I'll speak to you kind of as a parent as well, and as the Director of the Office of Early Learning. I probably should have started as well with really stopping more on this mission and vision. As you can see, our mission, the first word in our mission is to partner with families and communities. I really hear your passion that the young children in our state exist in the context of a family and in the context of communities, and those we have to be here to partner with them. And of course, nothing. I actually am a single parent. I'm a father, a divorced father of two daughters. And I can tell you that, and I was challenging someone recently and saying, you know, try to transform my children's life in a way that doesn't include me, it won't work. So we absolutely have to partner with families. We absolutely have to make sure that we're bolstering families and communities' capacity and ability to operationalize the love that they have for their children. It speaks to, I think, Representative Franzen's question as well. I can tell you that as a young parent, and I remember looking at my children and when they were first born and thinking, now what do? I look in the Yellow Pages to find a place to send them? And being so relieved to learn that a system, this was before I was in this position, like Parent Aware existed, and found the family child care that my daughters went through for years through Parent Aware, because it was a highly rated program, despite the fact that I did not qualify to receive a scholarship. And so just wanted to make that clear that we're fully aware that children, we have to be partnering with families and the communities and the providers, the people who are face-to-face with children on a day-to-day basis, in a way that we are not from state agencies or from the state capital. And that's really the exact focus. That's why there was such a strong focus at the end there on building community partnerships, so that everything that we build doesn't just sound good at the Capitol, but it also works well on the street level throughout our state. And I want to second the thanks about the way we chose to present this, because we definitely don't want to oversimplify and make it seem as though anyone sees children as a number.
Ms. Burnham?
Madam Chair, Representative, thank you for your comments. We absolutely do agree that parents are vital to succeeding in our mission of ensuring high-quality care for all of our young children. I think a couple points to remember is that this budget or this proposal, this early comprehensive early learning proposal, is about parent choice and about meeting families where their needs are and addressing their needs at wherever they are in their whether it be a single parent family home or a two parent or homeless or foster care. It is, this pre-K proposal is voluntary. It's being offered through a mixed delivery, so it does provide multiple choices for parents. And we built in a planning year to give programs, whether it be a community-based program in a school district, to work together to build those links so that by the time this gets implemented, some of those kinks are worked out. So we have a running list of questions from school districts and ways to address them and ways to provide support to the system to implement this program. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. I've got six more members at least on the list, and we're done at 2:30, so I'm going to ask members and testifiers to try to be succinct if we can, and apologize for lots of great questions. Chairman Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'd like to just disagree with Representative Quam a little bit. Aside from the word cloud in the presentation, I think it's awesome. I mean, look at that little baby. That's just and the one with the apple, even better. I think it's good. I think it's fine. Don't fire anybody except for the word cloud thing. Word cloud we could do without. My first question when I'm looking at this, I mean, it sounds great. You know, if I got three kids in the schools, I got Tommy, Tony, and Timmy. And Tommy's in first grade, Tony's in kindergarten, Timmy's a two-year-old. And Governor Dayton says, hey, we're going to have to go from, we're going to have free all-day kindergarten. I just paid $4,500 to have all-day K. Awesome. So I get that taken care of. Now I'm hearing, hey, Governor Dayton's going to say we're going to have all-day pre-K. That sounds even better for Tony. He's coming in. We can do that. We can have that lined up. And then little Timmy's coming along at 2 years old. Next year, in the next budget, we might have all-day three-year-old. You know, I don't know where this is going, but constituents, I'm seeing that this is a good thing for them to hear. But, however, I'm also hearing that only pays half the boat. And I got school districts that are already really short on cash. And as I've gone around to the schools in my district, I've heard a lot of them say that they need more resources. I've never had a single principal, teacher, anybody at a school say, Matt, you know what, we really need to go into the daycare business. We really need to go into the daycare business. And I know that there's a reason for that. It's because it's really hard, it's really expensive, and they got enough problems the way it is. So my question is real simple, keep it short. Where's the other half of the money come from just for the first part of that?
Ms. Burnham.
Madam Chair, Representative, there are multiple funding streams that would qualify to support districts in the implementation of that 0.5 match. And we've been having conversations with districts around those potential funding streams. I mean, I have a list of them here. It's about working with districts to possibly reprioritize, reallocate. For instance, there's an increase in the general ed fund. There's the literacy incentive aid, ECFE, Head Start, Taconite revenue, professional development, child care assistance, and that's just the state side. And there are several federal funding streams that could support the implementation of this program as well, such as school improvement grants, Title I Part A, the federal Head Start money, Title II Part A, migrant education, special ed Part B and C, special ed coordinated early intervening services, and special ed funds for state personnel grants. So it's a matter of making sure the right people are at the table to have the conversation around how to blend and braid these potential funding sources to support the implementation of this high-quality pre-K.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I think that's probably the we get a lot of people nervous when we're relying on federal funds, and obviously all of those resources have a lot of other places we're looking for. That will, I'm sure, start a conversation that we're going to hear a lot from schools about with this. So we look forward to that dialogue again, and I know I and a lot of the representatives here are going to be on the phone with local school districts to hear more about what they think of this idea and where we go from here. Thank you very much. Thank you for your presentation. Thank you for coming to the committee today.
Thank you. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for being here. I think this question is for you, Ms. Burnham. If a school district decides not to have this voluntary, full-day, high-quality pre-kindergarten early learning opportunity for their four-year-olds, will there still be the availability of school readiness?
Ms. Burnham.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative, the school readiness funding will be integrated into this model beginning in fiscal year 2017. So if a district chooses to offer the four-year-old program, they can tap into that four-year-old, that the
readiness,
the general ed funding. So part of the proposal is that school readiness will go away. Scholarships will be available still for school districts to potentially serve 3- and 4-year-olds in high-quality pre-Ks at that time.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, this is going to be problematic. I agree with Representative Dean when he noted that these categoricals that our K-12 system depend on, they've probably been tapped very, very nearly to the bone already. So, you know, we're going to have to think very carefully about moving in this direction. I think there certainly are some good things about it. I like the school readiness program because it targets, and I think that's a very important step. We don't have to offer this at the start to all four-year-olds, because I think parents, you know, when they hear a program is going to be free, they buy into it, and we want to make sure that they understand the intent of a four-year-old program, and I think the intent should be to target the learners. My last question is, we have some flexible learning years programs in our school districts. We just had one heard yesterday in my committee, Education Innovations, and I'm just wondering if the stipulations that I've heard about in regard to the requirements you're going to have for your program, what adjustment will they have to make? Will they be allowed to participate because now they have a four-day week, for example? I don't think the 45-15 will be affected, but how about the four-day week school years, assuming they'll proceed? What adjustments will they be forced to make? Will they fit into this model? Because there are going to be some grave questions. We have quite a few districts who have chosen that, and we may have more in the future.
Representative Burnham. All right. Ms. Burnham.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative, that's a really good question, and one that we will take back to our team and develop a answer to and get back to you.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Erickson. Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for investing so much in our kids. I think that continues a good trend after we've gone through a recession and a bunch of cutbacks. But my question is, and I want to say thank you for taking on the courage of working across silos. I know sometimes that's as difficult as our work working across party lines, and so I appreciate you doing that for the benefit of our kids. But I am a little confused, and that you can get back to us later on this, but I just really want to know how many kids are going to be left behind, even with all these different initiatives. It's hard to tell. We had asked for a report that came out in December on the waiting list within the Department of Human Services, and at that time, the estimate was, you know, almost 7,000 kids. Now we're down, I guess, closer to 6,000, families on the waiting list, which I guess is probably 10 to 12,000 kids. And the cost of getting rid of that was $80 million a year. And now you're getting rid of, you know, the wait list for Head Start. You're adding some flexibility on the scholarships and the all-day 4-year-old program. And I just still want to know how many kids are still going to be waiting, and an estimate of how many of those are the 0- to 2-year-olds. Because I know the wait list is as long as 2.5 years in some parts of the state. So if you could just kind of compare your list and come back to us, and If you can sort it out, families and kids, that would be great.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler, we will do that because I can give you, for example, the number of the reduction for the basic sliding fee, that wait list, what these numbers would mean. But you're right. We have to say, well, but if you take that with eliminating the Head Start waiting list and looking at this four-year-old program, you know, then what does it mean? So we'll work on that.
Thank you. Thank you. Representative Murphy. Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Jessen, at the start of your presentation, you talked about the number of kids who are living in poverty in Minnesota. Can you say that number again, please? Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Murphy. Actually, the number I used was for the number of kids living in deep poverty, and deep poverty is less than half of the federal poverty level, and that's 78,000 children.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Commissioner Jessen, is that a statewide problem? Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Murphy, that is very much a statewide problem.
Thank you. And one other fact regarding homelessness in Minnesota, and the reason why I bring this up is because I think we need to think about Minnesota as it exists, right? Not maybe just as we see it in our own districts, but as a statewide, how people are living their lives. There are the rate of homelessness among two-parent families in Minnesota has increased by 22% since 2009, between 2009 and 2012. So the two-parent solution, while I'm happy to be a part of a two-parent family, isn't necessarily the bullet. And I'm feeling a lot of urgency about this issue when I think about the workforce of the future and just the moral nature of what we're talking about in kids living in poverty. So I am delighted, really, at the hard work that the administration has done to put together a proposal that really does try and wrestle with how we better close the achievement gap and, for me, address that issue of poverty that seems chronic in our state. I introduced the pre-K bill last session, and again this session, and so I've been hearing from people a little bit about that and have gotten some email from child care providers, which, I want to compliment them on their honesty, but they do bring up their concern about, their profit margin as we talk about universal pre-K. And I am certain that the committee here is in agreement with me that while we should be sensitive to the businesses and the marketplace that is child care in Minnesota to make sure that there's adequate child care, that our kids can't be that profit margin and their well-being has to come first. And that's another thing that I want to say about the proposal. I do think, as I talked with providers and others over the course of the summer who are working in the 0 to 3 or 0 to 4 range, there's a lot that's happening, but a real sense, at least from my perspective, that those pieces don't necessarily fit together very well and are creating gaps for kids across the state of Minnesota. There was a woman who wrote to me who lives in the district I represent who's a child care provider, and she was also worried about the pre-K proposal, but she said to me, rather than don't do it, she said, can we figure out how to make sure that if we proceed with pre-K that my licensed child care facility can also fit in? Can we look at the way that child care providers are licensed, and are there ways that we can look at that as well so these two things fit together? So my question for the team, new team, is can you work with me on that in the days ahead as we think about pre-K and this proposal? Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Murphy, absolutely.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just one more question then. Can you just talk to me a little bit again about how pre-K and the Pathway 1 scholarships fit together? Because as I see that proposal, they are hand in glove. But I would like you to just expound on that for a moment. Thank you. Ms. Berman.
Madam Chair, Representative, we are working. We've received quite a bit of feedback around the scholarship program and the implementation of the scholarship program. So we are in conversation and in with the executive team around some potential enhancements to the scholarship system and the Pathway Ones. We feel that by funding this pre-K proposal in shifting those Pathway Two dollars to Pathway Ones, that it's going to provide greater choice for the 0 to 5 population. And so for those families who may not choose to attend a state-funded pre-K program, they still have the option of using a scholarship to attend the program of their choice.
Thank you. Members, we have reached the end of our time. I do have a couple of members still on the list, and I guess I'll ask the testifiers if you'd be willing to stay for a couple of minutes, and if the two members on the list could be very brief, because I hate to keep members here, I will allow the questions. So Representative Marquardt and Representative Liebling are the two people I have on the list. Representative Marquardt.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and I want to thank the chairs for holding this joint meeting, because I think we've had some good discussion, and while we can disagree on the details, this is really the first huge comprehensive plan I've seen in 15 years that really looks at the well-being of children. So I congratulate the governor for doing this. And a lot of the debate we're hearing right now on the pre-K is the same debate we really had on half-day, full-day kindergarten, where we had all the different studies and so forth. And while I think the studies will show, will weigh on the side of the effectiveness, let's just throw the studies aside for a second. And look at what the experts really think, those who know the children the best and whether or not this is good for them or not, and those are the parents. And we know the parents said overwhelmingly that full-day, everyday kindergarten is the way to go. In fact, parents were paying $26 million a year on full-day, everyday kindergarten, willing to do that. And I think we should allow parents to do the same with pre-K. And what I see here is a lot of different options for parents. And I'm somewhat surprised that some around this table who tend to support all sorts of parental choice in K through 12 seem to want to restrict it when it comes to pre-K, that parental choice. And so I think we've got a good program here. And one quick question that's come up is, Mr. Carter, isn't there a provision in the early learning scholarships within a year or so that you have to come back with a report on outcomes, on how effective the early learning scholarships are? That'd be my question. Thank you.
Mr. Carter.
Madam Chair, Representative, that is actually, I'm going to defer that question to Director Burnham as well.
Madam Chair, thank you. And I'm looking over at Lisa Barnage because I can't remember the exact date when that report is due. January 2016.
Okay.
So we are working on it as we speak.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to say I'm also very concerned, as Representative Murphy is, about the numbers of kids in deep poverty. I really commend the governor for his focus on children, on young children and education. I think that's really wonderful. I'm glad to see it. But I want to know how this proposal responds to the evidence we have that most of that brain growth occurs between 0 and 3, because I'm not seeing that focus here. There's some that's great, but how does this really address what we know about brain growth in children?
Ms. Burnham?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. The 0 to 3 population, as we all know, has really risen above to the surface as a priority area. And we are definitely including that in our work. I think part of the work that we do in communities is to ensure that 0 to 8 continuum is addressed, and that not only child care providers, Head Start directors, elementary school principals are full aware that it really begins at birth. So part of our priority at the Department of Ed is providing technical assistance and professional learning for those directors, those Head Start directors, those elementary principals, about deepening their knowledge base on that 0 to 3 population so they have a fuller understanding of how important it is to connect those services, to partner with those programs in the community. So that's one way we think through that at the Department of Ed.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, a couple of things from a DHS perspective. One, I think the more kids that aren't on waiting list for our child care assistance program but are in child care, and that's not a kind of 4 and 5 year old, that's starting, you know, at the very beginning, and to make sure that parents have the choice of having being quality child care will be huge. I also think being able to use the scholarships, not just for the 4 and 5 year olds, but really starting in a 0 to 3 is another big step. And finally, one of the things, a small budgetary item, but I think will be really helpful, is that mental health consultation service for the child care centers that serve them starting, you know, at the infants through five. And we would target the help, that consultation help, for the providers that are serving kind of high-risk, low-income families.
And Madam Chair and Representative from the Department of Health, certainly family home visiting gets at those foundational things that you're talking about, parents as the first teachers, and so this moves us forward a bit in supporting our family home visiting program.
Thank you. I'm going to take the liberty of asking one last question, then I know we've got another committee coming in here, so we'll have to close it off. But just, you know, with the discussion and highlighting the numbers of families in deep poverty and in poverty and however you want to categorize that, people of economic need and children in families of economic need existing, I just question a little bit the governor's initiative to move to school-based programs, which are entitlement. So every child is entitled to education in a four-year-old program if you go to that school base, as we have with kindergarten. So families of great wealth would be able to avail themselves of that in addition to the children in poverty. Similarly with the breakfast program expansion through K through third grade, regardless of economic need of family. With resources so scarce, and some great questions on that, why move in that direction where it's not targeted to those most in need? Mr. Carter.
Madam Chair, thank you so much for the question. I think it's a great question, and it's an important question because there's a number of routes that we could go as a state. There's a universal, there's a statewide route, there's a targeted route, there's a number of different routes that we could go as a state. At the core, I think what we're doing when we acknowledge as a state, as we have already through all the investments that we're making and the fact that we're even here today, that young children are really a priority. I think, it seems to me that we've made it our business a long time ago as a state to make sure that children raised in Minnesota receive a first-notch education. We know, based on a lot of research, that there are, segments of our population who have historically and traditionally been left behind there. But the information that we have now that we didn't have before on how and when brains develop, we've talked about that today, I think just makes it clear that when we see that as our business, we have to see our commitment to young people having access to a first-rate education starting before age six. And so that's where just building the robust kind of systems comes into play. And so I think there's a lot of evidence that diverse learning environments benefit everyone. There's a lot of evidence that bringing different people from different backgrounds into the same class gives an opportunity for more learning to happen. And I think this this proposal advances all of those things.
Any comments? All right. With that, I apologize. We've run way over, but thank you very much for being here. And the committee is adjourned.